Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today's session is entitled Doing Theology with Robert Frost, led by Brad Benow. Session number BIB 92-8. Let's listen in.
We're going to do theology with Robert Frost, or more technically, I guess we should say, with the poetry of Robert Frost. How many of you were here last week when I did a presentation of Robert Frost's poetry? Was anybody here who heard that? Right? Nobody. Whole new slate. Okay. How many are here with the Elder Hostel this week? Fair number. Okay. Well, last Wednesday I did a program of speaking a number of Frost poems, most of which I put up here on the board. But tonight I really want this to be a very participatory session. This is not performance time by me. This is a chance for all of us to jump in and share comments. I consider myself maybe something like a guide on the trip here, but I can't and won't do the walking for you. You know, I can maybe steer us a little bit this way or that way. When I talk about doing theology, sometimes that's a phrase that people puzzle about and say, "Well, what do we mean by that?" All I mean by that is we're going to look into these poems for ultimate things. I'll say anything is fair game, any comments you want to share are fair game, but let's try to direct them toward ultimate things. What really matters, life and death-wise, for us? And how is Robert Frost speaking to that? And by no means am I suggesting that we have to agree with everything that he's saying. You may find in some of these poems that that's a very foreign notion to me. I can't believe someone would want to live their life that way, whatever. What I'd like to do is, come in. If there are particular poems that are favorites of yours or that you'd like to talk about, then let's get those on the table. I will, if they're one of the ones on the board which I have committed to memory, then I will speak them for you so we can do that. I have some photocopies of some of these poems, so if that's the case, then I'll be glad to hand some out so you can look at the text if you want. If you don't have any favorites, then I'm prepared to suggest some things that we can talk about. I'd like to restrict ourselves to these selections. You may have a really favorite Frost poem. And we can probably share that. Here I have the complete unabridged collection. We can find it and talk about it. All I'm saying is these are the poems that I've put the most time in on and which I can probably be the most faithful guide on, but I guess I shouldn't really set that limitation. If you have something that's really burning in your heart and mind, why, we can certainly take it on. How many of you have read say more than just Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening by Robert Frost? Half or so. How many of you have never read anything by Robert Frost? A couple of you who are honest enough to admit. Okay, but are here because your spouse dragged you or something. There wasn't anything else to do. Okay. Let me just open it up. Is there a favorite poem you'd like to dig into? A thought you have about Robert Frost? Question on Bill in the back. Go ahead. Birches.
And Fire and Ice.
Fire and Ice. Okay, great. I think those are two.
Where
really
was that taken?
All right. Let's go with those three and see how far we can get. Because they're all laden with good theological insights. Hi, come on in. Well, let's start with Fire and Ice. Can we do that? And then we'll do Birches and then Road Not Taken. Help me remember what we said. Fire and Ice is a fairly short poem, just two stanzas long. Someone has said that this may be the most perfectly crafted poem in the English language. I don't know about that, but if you listen, it's very tight. Rhyme scheme is exact, the meter is precise, and as is the case with most of Frost's poems, he gives you a little zing at the end. Well, let me share it with you, then let's talk about it. Fire and Ice. Some say the world will end in fire. Some say in ice. From what I've tasted of desire, I'd hold with those who favor fire. But if it had to perish twice, I think I know enough of hate to say that for destruction, ice is also great and would suffice. And let me look, because I may have a copy of this, and we can share those. Let's see, it was last week when Jonathan Frerichs was here, and I suppose not many of you were here then, but Jonathan did some wonderful presentations on mountains and mountain stories, and one of the things he talked about in his presentation about Mount Kilimanjaro was the way that both fire and ice have crafted that mountain. If you know about this mountain in Tanzania, it's right on the equator. It was formed as the result of a volcano, but now there are actually almost glacial formations at the top of this 19,000 foot mountain. Much argued about in the 19th century, before Europeans came to this mountain, you know, could there really be snow at the equator? And they said, no, that's impossible. But somehow this curious combination in that place of fire and ice coexisting, the sort of building up by fire and the tearing down by ice. Well, okay, now I see that I only have only one copy of this. So I'll have to ask you to treat it from memory there, I think. Bill, it was your poem. What kind of reflection do you share about it?
I just remember it being so clever and so funny.
Ah. Is it still clever and funny?
Yeah.
Okay.
Very good, yeah. But I'm interested in doing theology, I don't really put much theological thought into it.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting.
Well,
obviously it's talking about the end time, but
yeah. Or maybe not. Let me focus attention on these couple of words. He says, from what I've tasted of desire, I hold with those who favor fire. Then in the second verse he says, I think I know enough of hate to say that for destruction ice is also great and would suffice. So you've got kind of desire on the one hand and hate on the other hand as the opposite emotions that he's linking. I mean, it's not just fire and ice as sort of forces of nature. I think he's bringing this into a very personal realm. So he's linking fire with desire and hate with ice. Does that conjure up anything for you? I mean, what sense do you make out of that?
I'd get out of the love is superior to hatred, you know. Even though he chose the hatred half, the ice half, but that's for destruction, you see.
Yeah. For destruction, ice is also great and would suffice. It's a very casual thing. It would do if you had to destroy. Why, sure, it would suffice.
He seems to be sitting on the fence.
Which you often find him doing, actually. Yeah. But yeah, how so? How do you see that?
Well, he hasn't committed to either one.
Aha. Uh-huh. Which I think is part of the genius of Robert Frost, that in many poems, he does not make up your mind for you. He invites you into the poem and sort of forces you to get involved with it, and you have to decide. It's a little bit like the poem The Road Not Taken, where if you listen to that poem carefully, you'll notice he doesn't tell you how he feels about the path that he took. In the end, you're left to decide, was this a wise choice or not? So here, now, fire or ice, if it has to go down, you know, what's your choice?
Well, one always thinks that fire in relation to people, passion, that sort of thing, rather than in the ice, well, that's just a cold, cold reception by people.
Yeah. You know, it took me a long time of reciting this poem and working with it before I began to focus on that issue of the desire being a kind of, well, as fire is a consuming sort of thing, and your passions can consume not only you but other people. Whereas, as you said, the ice is a kind of freezing people out. Hatred is a very cold emotion for the most part. I think it puts distance between us and others. So I come around to wondering if maybe he's suggesting that you can fall off the table on either side, you know, If you really want to mess up your life, you can let your passions run away with you to the point where you will be consumed by fire. You'll lose focus. You'll burn out, as we say. On the other hand, if you're kind of coolly indifferent to everything, if you have no passion at all, you kind of ice people out. Your hatred becomes consuming. You want distance between you and everything. And I think he's saying, you can foul up your life either way, pretty much. Which, that's a little different, Bill, from what you were suggesting, that maybe it's about the end times. Well, say more about that. How would you see that?
Well, now, with that added, expanded understanding, it's clear that the end times would be the end of your own life. Mm-hmm. We all face our own end. And you're going to go out with a burning flame of passion, or freeze ourselves to death with it. Yeah.
I think that's a good theological insight, and that's what I'm trying to suggest that we can do by way of doing theology with this is, yeah, we would think very theologically about the end times, what Christians call eschatology, a Greek word for end times. But one theological point to be made is that we also realize those end times in our own life, both the judgment that's implied in the end times and the joy that's implied in the end times. Some theologians call that realized eschatology, simply meaning that the birth and death and resurrection of Jesus have brought into our present time some future vision of the end time. So, yeah, maybe here he's offering us a kind of eschatological poem, a glimpse of the end times brought into our own life. So we can weigh the advantages and disadvantages of just how it is that we want to do our living. Yeah.
But in that case, eschatology is an extension of the choices we make in our own lives. It's not a radical discontinuity with life as we know it now. It's a logical extension.
Which I think is what C.S. Lewis would say, for instance. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's in a school of thought that would suggest that the continuity of your choices or mischoices, as he would put it, build a sequence of things that one day we will all look back on and say, I didn't see it at the time, but now I see how it's unfolded, my series of choices. Yeah, yeah. Which is not the whole point, obviously, as you're saying, about eschatology, about the end times. Yeah.
Did Frost ever do anything about this implied theology, like Charles Schulz did with Peanuts?
Yeah.
I read Frost before I went to seminary. Yeah. So I'm a little void of theological thought. It took me many months.
Yeah. No, I don't think so. Frost was not, do a little history on him here for a minute perhaps. He was not a very overtly religious person. He was kind of your basic non-denominational monotheist. His mother was very devout and schooled him well in Bible, and you'll find a lot of biblical references in his poems, but not with a particularly theological point that he wants to make. He was a very literate person, and in that sense he knew Bible as literature. I think if you listen to his poems, you're hard-pressed to really figure out where he is theologically. But that doesn't mean that we can't, because his poems are really fine forms of art, that we can't use them to think theologically, to help us. I mean, good art always pushes us to ask questions about ultimate things, and I think these are really fine poems, and he was a master poet, certainly wonderful insight. So, I don't know if that helps, but, let's see. Well, you also suggested birches, right? I think about this poem also in a kind of end times sense. Do any of you know this poem or know the gist of this poem, Birches? A couple of you. This one I think I have some copies of. I believe. We could put those in front of us. I didn't know quite how to organize all this, so you'll bear with me a second. Here we go. Tell you what, let me speak the poem first. I think it's better if you hear it without having to look at the words while you're hearing it. Need to say, you've seen birch trees that are, how sometimes they bend way over. You know, often they're very straight, but sometimes they're bent almost to the point that the top is touching the ground. And you have to think like a child almost to get into the mood of this poem, where Frost apparently has seen these kind of drooping birch trees and is musing, you know, how do they get that way? Now, probably it's some force of nature, you know, they're not very sturdy trees when they're young and the wind or the weather or whatever. But he begins to muse that could it be that a person could climb a tree, maybe a small boy, and actually, you know, start swinging these things back and forth until, as he says in the poem, until he took the stiffness out of them. You know, it's a very interesting thought. You can't actually believe that it could be done, but he builds a whole poem around the attitude of a child who would approach birch trees. But you really need to hear the poem from the standpoint of an old person thinking back, as you'll see in near the end of the poem. He's really ruminating back on his early life, maybe his own childhood, lost innocence, something like that. So here it is, birches. When I see birches bend to left and right across the lines of straighter, darker trees, I like to think some boy's been swinging them. But swinging doesn't bend them down to stay, as ice storms do. Often, you must have seen them loaded with ice a sunny winter morning after a rain. They click together as the breeze rises and turn many colored as the stir cracks and crazes their enamel. Soon the sun's warmth makes them shed crystal shells, shattering and avalanching on the snow crust such heaps of broken glass to sweep away, you'd think the inner dome of heaven had fallen. They are dragged to the withered bracken by the load, and they seem not to break. Though once bowed so low for long, they never right themselves. You may see their trunks arching forward in the woods years afterward, trailing their leaves on the ground like girls on hands and knees that throw their hair before them over their heads to dry in the sun. But I was going to say, when Truth broke in with all her matter of fact about the ice storm, that I should prefer to have some boy bend them. As he went out and in to fetch the cows, to some boy too far from town to learn baseball, whose only play was what he found himself and could play alone. One by one, he subdued his father's trees, riding them down over and over again until he took the stiffness out of them. And not one but hung limp. Not one was left for him to conquer. He learned all there was to learn about not launching out too soon, and so not carrying the tree away clear to the ground. He always kept his poise, to the top branches climbing carefully with the same pains you use to fill a cup, up to the brim, and even above the brim. And then he flung outward, feet first, with a swish, kicking his way down through the air to the ground. So was I once myself, a swinger of birches. And so I dream of going back to be. It's when I'm weary of considerations and life is too much like a pathless wood where your face burns and tickles from cobwebs broken across it, and one eye is weeping from a twig having lashed across it open. I'd like to get away from Earth a while, then come back to it and begin over. Oh, may no fate willfully misunderstand me and half grant what I wish and whisk me away not to return. Earth's the right place for love. Can't imagine where it's likely to go better. I'd like to go by climbing a birch tree. Climb black branches up a snow-white trunk till the tree could bear no more, but dipped its top and set me down again. That would be good. Both going and coming back, one could do worse than be a swinger of birches. Yeah. Okay, let's see here. I've got, I'm sure not enough copies of this for everybody, but spread them around and see what you can do.
Send them a few that way and a couple of
them. What images does that conjure up for you?
Freedom.
Freedom.
Liberation.
Aha. Uh-huh. From what?
Yeah. From boundaries.
Yeah.
Things that find us down.
He said,
I always liked it because I always felt kind of stupid.
Yeah, yeah. He says, it's when I'm weary of considerations. That's a loaded word, you know. I mean, not much used, actually, I don't think. But what could you take that to mean? What are these considerations? He says, it's when I'm weary of considerations and life is too much like a pathless wood where your face burns and tickles, etc. What do you think he's talking about there?
Complete vacation.
To vacate, right?
Retirement.
Yeah, retirement. No more considerations. I don't know. As a pastor, I find that very much of my time is taken up with what I would call considerations. Spend a lot of time, I mean, at my desk or talking with people or in the shower in the morning, just considering what's the best move to make, you know? Do I do this or do I do that? Do I visit her or do I visit him? Do I start this program or do I start that program? Do I stop this program or do I stop that? A constant weighing of alternatives. I guess that's one of the reasons we come to Holden, where many things are decided for us, you know, meal times are set and the schedule is clear. You just don't have to consider as many things here. It's a kind of nice relief. What else? What else do you sense out of this poem?
The images are fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
Drying your hair and boy and the breaking of the glass, the ice of that glass.
Yeah, filling it up to the brim, above the brim.
Of course, that strange phrase, as I was saying, the truth broke out.
Yes.
Never did understand what the truth was.
Yeah.
So the truth, I guess, is...
Well, that is interesting. Notice how he starts out. He says, when I see birches bend to left and right across the lines of straighter, darker trees, I like to think some boy's been swinging them.
Because obviously he used to do it as a boy.
Yeah, he has some memory of this. But then immediately he's gotten that thought out on the table, this fanciful, romanticized, whimsical, innocent, youthful thought. And then immediately he goes into this sequence of nature. He says, but swinging doesn't bend them down to stay as ice storms do. You know, swinging, they would eventually right themselves. But then he goes into this several lines of the business about the ice storms and the ice laden and the sun's warmth makes them shed their crystal shells, you know, shattering on the snow crusts, heaps of broken glass. Anyway, it's all about nature, all about the real world. And then he says, yeah, but I was going to say when truth broke in with all her matter of fact about the ice storm, as if to say, the natural explanation is a rather boring one. You know, let's get on with this poetic understanding of some little boy who can do even more than nature can do. It's a whimsical kind of thought, I think. It's almost as if he interrupts himself. He can't help but interrupt himself with the logic, I can never remember, is that left brain or right brain? Left brain is the logical stuff, okay. So kind of a left brain thought, and then he forces himself to get back to the right brain thinking of being a poet again.
But it's interesting that he labels truth with a capital T.
Yes.
You know, with a capital T,
that's right.
That truth, as he's describing it, is actually rather matter of fact. That's the truth of nature. But what he really wants to do is fantasize, some of which is remembering being a boy, but much of which is fantasy about what? About having an impact upon nature.
Yeah.
About play that leaves a mark
for a lifetime.
Yeah.
And the thing that struck me when you read it is the potential sexual imagery of playing with one's father's trees.
That's very interesting.
That's and not regretting. You know, not regretting it.
That's really interesting.
What else to tell?
Yeah. Somebody else had a hand back here. Let's jump into that.
I see it. So my fantasy is I saw it as sort of a willing suspension of disbelief, almost a worldview, that there are times when he's taken away from the view of the world that he would prefer to have and is thrust into the coldness of reality, but that because he was a farmer in New England.
Yes.
And but that by and large, he chose New England because of nature and its beauty and so on, and that would be his preferred view. Mm-hmm. And that he had, it almost as if he says that he preferred the vision of, and that he talks of going back to that in old age.
Yes.
I'm wondering if he feels that there's a time of, I almost thought of it as toil in the middle of life, when we aren't able to go back to the joy of our boyhood, that we wish.
But isn't it true that in our later years we become, if we're lucky, more childlike again, usually, I think? You're done with some of those considerations and freed up from some of that. Notice that there's a great... No? He's saying,
no,
not so.
No, not so.
Okay. No. Share your perspective.
Well, I didn't know you were going to call
him. Oh, well, you don't have to.
The point that I see, if this is related in any sense to theology, if it's in this statement, Earth's the right place for love, I don't know where it's likely to get better. That perhaps is an agnostic statement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know, but I'll take my chances here.
Otherwise, it seems to me he's an incurable romantic.
He was in some ways.
Yeah. Which makes him very attractive.
Right. Earth's the right place for love. Go ahead.
Well, I have certainly found, with advancing age, more fantasizing might be the word, but enjoying things in nature, and I guess I could say fantasizing, much more than I could through so much of my life when everything was concrete.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there is a romanticizing as one gets older.
Hmm.
I don't call it childishness, because to me that's different.
I would want to make a real clear distinction between childish and childlike.
Yes.
Childish, I hope we leave behind us, because none of us need that in our adult life. But childlike, you know, a recapturing of some of the wonderfulness of life, you know, hello world, it's wonderful. There's a little boy in the village last week, he was living in the same chalet we were in, he's a little over 2 years old, and his mother said that he's full of such energy that when they would take him to the beach near where they live, even though he's been there 100 times, he will still run down to the shore and say, "Mama, water! Look at the water!" You know. Most of us would get a little jaded, you know. It's the water, you know. It's nice to have that sense come back. Notice how as the poem sort of winds down toward the end, there is that very self-reflective section where he says, it's when I'm weary of considerations and life is too much like a pathless wood where your face burns and tickles from cobwebs broken across it. Now, on the one hand, you can sense what that's like if you walk down a trail and there's a spider web or something and you get that in the face, you know. But someone has suggested that he's also, very poetically perhaps, talking about the wrinkle lines that inevitably increase on our face as the years come by. That's kind of a nice image, the cobwebs kind of break out across your face, you know. And one eye is weeping from a twig having lashed across it open. Again, double meaning. We know literally what that's like if you get sapped in the eye there on the trail and you didn't see it coming. But life has a way of doing that. Not always big, severe injuries, although sometimes we have to suffer those too, but these little inconvenient, you know, stinging moments, you just get a little tired of putting up with that, these considerations, as he's saying. So that I'd like to get away from Earth a while. Not forever, you know. May I not be misunderstood and get taken away so that I don't get a chance to come back, but just for a moment. And so I wonder if part of what he's saying is a poem can do that for you. A poem can lift you out of your reality, at least for a moment, suspend that reality, and then, as he says at the end, set you back down again. Someone has suggested that that last line, that climb black branches up a snow-white trunk, looks something like, you know, the poem on the printed page. If the white page is the trunk and the lines of poetry are something like the branches, you can climb that to whatever, you know, whatever height it can take you, but you don't want to stay there because that's not really the real world, and the truth with a capital T is important, and you do have to come back. But it'll gently, a good poem should gently ease you back into reality, and not sort of snap you around, perhaps. Yeah. Well, any more mileage we want to get out of that one?
What's the last line again?
One could
do worse
than be a swinger of birches. See, I wonder if he's perhaps saying, one could do worse than be a poet. You know? Some may think that poets are just kind of, you know, time-wasting ne'er-do-wells that are fantasizing and romanticizing, but he's sort of maybe subtly arguing here for his vocation. You could do worse than this. It may not answer all questions in all time, but, you know, it's got something to be said for it.
Sounds kind of like the Jewish sage. One could do worse. Yeah.
One could do worse. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Well, want to move on? Mm-hmm. Let's see. Somebody else had another poem.
The Road Not Taken.
Yeah. How many people had to learn this somewhere back in sixth grade or something? Anybody? Okay. I'd ask you to pay attention to the rhyme scheme here because it's very carefully worked out. There are four line stanzas. The first, second, and fourth rhyme. The third line introduces the rhyme of the next verse. And it follows through very nicely until the end when, of course, he repeats the last line, I have promises to keep, etc. Also take note of the fact, like as is the case with almost all of his poems, he gives you a title that very nicely sums up what the poem is about, but it is not a line from the poem itself. There's a genius to writing titles, and I think he was excellent at that. I mean, the poems aside, what he could say with a title is, in my opinion, a kind of understudied and under-examined aspect of his work. Anyway, The Road... No, wait a minute. Which one are we talking about here? What am I talking about? Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. I always get these mixed up. Forget everything I just said about the rhyme scheme. It sounded good. We could do that one, too. I don't know why I got sidetracked. The Road Not Taken. I better just do this poem, and then we'll talk about it. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both, and be one traveler long I stood, and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then took the other as just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim, because it was grassy and wanted wear. Though as for that, the passing there had worn them really about the same. Both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden black. I saved the first for another day, yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this tale with a sigh somewhere, ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. Okay. What I said about the title still holds. I took the one less traveled by, but the title is The Road Not Taken. Now, the key point in this poem, I think, which I missed innumerable times as I have worked with this, until finally I picked it up. He says, then took the other as just as fair. He doesn't say, then I took the other path. The word as is all important here. I took the other as just as fair. In other words, I looked at that and I considered that that had as much right to be walked down as the first path. Because he doesn't tell you in the end whether he's happy or sad about the choice that he makes. There's no evaluation. No. I shall be telling this tale with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverge in the wood. I took the road less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. But what kind of difference? You know, you can read it as an upbeat, I'm glad I did that, I stayed off the, you know, well-worn track. Or you can take that as, you know, I had my chance, there was no way to know, I went this way, and life sure would have been different had I gone the other way. That seems to me. Anyway, what do you think? How does it strike you? And I will look. I don't think I have copies of this, but
that's all of us.
Yeah?
We all have choices to make.
Yeah? Do you see yourself as life goes on looking back and saying, I could have made different decisions?
I could have, but thankfully I didn't.
Ah, okay. I don't have it. I'm always a little bit skeptical, frankly, of people who say, if I had my life to live over again, I wouldn't change a thing. Something about that suggests to me that's a person who maybe hasn't learned as much as they could have along the way. I think if we're attentive, I think we'd all say that, I made some mistakes. If I could do it again, I'd change a few things at least. I don't know.
But you know, the genius of that poem is you could take it as a young person as a plea for nonconformity.
Yes.
And you take it as an older person as a kind of confirming that what you did.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's got this wide appeal.
Yeah.
So you could read it as a young person to an old person in a different kind of way.
It's a very interesting point. He doesn't really clue us in about the age of the teller. He does say, I shall be telling this tale somewhere ages and ages hence, but you could be relatively well on into life and still say that with meaning and conviction, as well as, you know, a teenager, probably.
It's autobiographical to me that he made a choice to be a poet, which is certainly a less traveled route than most people.
Yeah, he took some abuse for that. When he started out at Harvard University, didn't actually fare very well there. He had a penchant for kind of going off and taking long walks on his own, and he liked to go out into the woods and so forth. And his friends at school thought this was pretty odd. You know, he didn't study in the conventional way that you were supposed to. And finally, they started bugging him about this. You know, what are you doing out there in the woods? You know, what's all this about? And then they needled him, and they wouldn't leave him alone. And so finally, one day he said, when they asked, you know, what are you doing out there? He said, I'm biting the trees. And they left him alone. Well, any other thoughts about that or another poem?
The only thing is, the people that would say what you just said, that you said that they would you have problems with them, they might are saying perhaps that they feel that they've been divinely led in their life and they have no regrets.
Mm-hmm. Well, good point to do some theology with. Is Frost making a theological point here that we would agree with or disagree with, that we have much of the possibility to even make choices in our life? Or, you know, is God in charge, leading us, helping to orchestrate events in such a way that our lives come out to the place that God wants them to come out? Is Frost really barking up a false tree here by even holding up the notion that we have many choices to make.
Well, at the moment, it was a choice. I mean, you come up to a situation, and maybe it's going to be something you have to make a choice very, very quickly. And yet, it has a profound influence on all the rest of your life.
Huh.
Because I remember a couple.
Yeah. Okay. What do you think? I mean, how real are the choices that we have to make?
Well, we were in Germany in this congregation that I served there. The conclusion was that most of the girls are going to marry farmers. That's just a foregone conclusion. The other part of Germany, that the sons of the coal miners are going to be coal miners. How much choice is that?
Right.
You're kind of locked in by occupation.
Yeah, but realistically, I mean, for some people, that's really not much of a choice, you know. We say that sometimes about people in the inner city today, you know, who are locked into a cycle of poverty or joblessness and so forth, and we want to say, well, you know, it's America, it's a free country, do be whatever you want to be, and yet we know realistically that for some life just isn't long enough for some people to work themselves out of the circumstances which have been handed to them. And the choices may be rather limited. Yeah, please.
It seems to me that what he's saying is that there are times in your life where there are two paths you might take, maybe career-wise or whatever, and you'll really never know what might have happened had you accepted the other one, had you chosen the other one. That's something you just don't know.
Yeah, he says, I looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. You know, a very clear realization that, as you know from the trails around here, you know, you can look all you want, but you really can't see very much. I mean, if you stand down here at the fork where the Heart Lake Trail goes to the left and the Holden Lake Trail goes to the right, and if you've never seen postcards of what's at the other end, so you didn't know, you know, you wouldn't have a clue from either trail about what you were going to end up with. I mean, it's just A and B. How could you know?
Yeah. Aren't you always making decisions without complete information?
Ah, yes. Sure. Back to the considerations, right. Yeah. Yeah. There's almost a longing here, isn't there? He wishes he had more information. You know, and he's sizing it up. I looked as hard as I could, then I looked at this one, and then they were both about the same.
How can he say that made all the difference?
Well, we don't know what happened.
Yeah, we don't know what the magnitude of the decision is talking about.
Hindsight is different than foresight. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know?
Well, it does make all the difference in the sense that, you know, choosing one way, looking back, leads to all these consequences, but you don't know what the consequences of the other choice would have been. And musing on it is perhaps productive. In a non-productive kind of a way.
Spoken like a poet.
At least you know how one side came out after you traveled the road. Yeah. So if you have any joys or regrets or whatever, you kind of, you know.
Yeah.
You at least know one side of the road.
Well, more thoughts or another poem?
New poem.
Okay, new poem. Any questions? Any titles up here intrigue you? You may not know the poem, but...
I know the stuff in my woods that you...
Oh, okay, we better do that since I started off on the wrong track. Yeah, Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. Interesting story about this poem. Frost liked to say, and was often quoted as saying, that the poet writes in what he called a state of grace. The muse beckons, and you get the idea, and when it comes, it just comes, you know, it just flows. And he was on public record as saying about this poem, Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening, that he came out, he had been working on this very long, long, difficult narrative poem called New Hampshire, late into the night, and which is an interesting poem. The last line is, 'Tis pleasant to be thinking of New Hampshire,
At present, I'm living in Vermont. you know about Vermonters in New Hampshire. It's a hammer and tongue. Anyway, he said, I came out, and it was about 4 or 5 in the morning, and the snow was gently falling, and kind of in a state of grace, this poem just came to me. Well, it was subsequently discovered at the University of Michigan, which has been the repository of most of his papers because he taught in Ann Arbor for part of his life, that in fact there were 3 or 4 or 5 different drafts of this poem. And he worked this poem very diligently. He corrected and refined and changed. In fact, that's one of the very interesting things about this the complete and unabridged volume here, put out by Holt Reinhardt Winston, that in the back, this is even worth looking up here, they give you all of the variations of all of the ways that the poem had ever been published. Here it's not as complete as I thought it was. Okay. I know more about this than this book does, which is rare. Okay, I'll tell you one thing. In this poem, for instance, he said he changed the gender of the horse. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near, blah, blah, blah. It came out, he gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake. Well, originally it was, she gives her harness bells a shake. I don't know why, but he changed that. In any event, these drafts were found that suggest that he did not write this in a state of grace. He actually worked very hard on it. I guess probably what this book means is that none of those earlier versions probably ever were published. He worked it out to get what he wanted before he sent it into publication. So here's the poem, and then let's talk about it. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though he will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near between the woods and frozen lake the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other sounds the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep and miles to go before I sleep. Miles to go before I sleep. Now, what I was saying previously is true about this poem. Notice how the rhyme scheme fits. Yeah. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here. Watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer. Picks up the third line of his... And then that rhymes the next, and then he introduces a new word in the third and picks it up in the next verse. Carefully crafted poem. I mean, it beguiles you because it's usually there in most elementary literature collections of American poetry, but it's, I think it's rich with meaning. Deep poem. Yeah, please.
The inbreaking of grace does not contradict the necessity for work.
Interesting. Yeah.
That's not a comment about the poem, but a comment about your comment. About grace.
Okay. He is, in a sense, in a state of grace.
Yes.
But he works that idea to an even more refined presentation.
Right.
Yeah. That's a good insight, I think. Even though, if I were to take it back to the poem, I think he's saying, even though I have this very graceful, grace-filled moment, lovely woods, dark, deep, etc., there are still things I must do. I can't withdraw totally from life and just kick back and enjoy. I must get on with and pursue. Often people, you know, these last two lines, because he repeats them is with this dramatic emphasis, you know, miles to go before I sleep, people always wanted to ask him, well, what do you really mean by that? And he always resisted an interpretation. He said, you know, it's up to you to decide. He didn't want to explain it. People have often thought that the reference to death, you know, I have much to do before the sleep of death, but he never commented one way or the other. He said, as you wish, you know. Yeah.
was the poem he read at Kennedy's inauguration? Was it more than one?
Well, it was called I remember this right, The Gift Outright. Hmm. But he was not able, you may remember, he was not able to read the poem that he wrote.
Yes.
Because the sun was so bright and the January day was blinding, and he had his manuscript here, and his eyes weren't very good. He was 82 or 3 years old. He was very near death. He died the next year, I think.
Yeah.
No, he died in 1963, so it was a few years before that. So he recited from memory a different poem. But in that poem, he said, I've tried to memorize that, and it sort of defies me. But he does say something like, summoning artists to participate in august occasions of the state seems something artists ought to celebrate. In a nice way. I mean, when else have we sort of taken poets and put them on right at the front and center of a national event? I mean, that was a touch of class, I think, you know, think whatever you may about Kennedy's politics and life, but that spoke well, I think, for trying to infuse a little bit of literary consciousness in a national event. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he is forever remembered by that moment of fumbling on the podium and Lyndon Johnson trying to sort of hold his top hat and shade the page. And but he was not really very good, I don't think, at rendering his own poems orally. I remember a friend of mine told me she was listening to Minnesota Public Radio one time, and she picked up that this was a poem of Robert Frost, and she said, I couldn't believe this guy who was reading it. He was just butchering it. It was gravelly voice, and rah, rah, rah. And then at the end, the commentator said, and that was an original recording of Robert Frost reading one of his own poems. And I've heard a little bit of him, and he really wasn't very good. He didn't have an orally artistic way about it, but he certainly had it when it came to writing. Well, we've got time for one or two more here.
I don't think we've ever put a poet in the public eye since then.
Not that I can think of. Some have suggested that if we had there was a piece in Newsweek, this was a number of years ago, suggesting that if we ever get around to naming an official poet laureate of the United States, maybe it ought to be Robert Frost. He captured a certain spirit of what America was about. Although, if you read his poems carefully, he would certainly be a Republican. I mean, he was a very conservative person in his outlook, his economic outlook, but he also had a belief that, government could not solve people's problems, and people ought to be encouraged to do for themselves as much as they can.
New England independent spirit. Catherine Hepburn type.
Well, here's a poem maybe to illustrate that. I'll throw one out. It's called Provide, Provide. Helps if you know in this poem who the biblical character, a little bit of Bible showing up for him, the biblical character of Abishag. Anybody know who that person is in the Old Testament?
The one who warns David?
Yeah.
Tries to warn David before he dies?
Yeah. Old King David, decrepit on his deathbed, is chilled, and so the word goes out into the kingdom to find the most beautiful woman in all the realm, medicinal purposes only, of course, who can warm the king on his dying days. Right, well, yeah, it helps to know that Abishag was the most beautiful one in the kingdom. Okay, he wrote this poem around the time when there was a public workers' strike in Boston, and so he was making commentary about that. The witch that came, the withered hag, to wash the steps with pail and rag, was once the beauty Abishag. The picture pride of Hollywood. Too many fall from great and good for you to doubt the likelihood. Die early and avoid the fate. Or, if predestined to die late, make up your mind to die in state. Make the whole stock exchange your own. If need be, occupy a throne where nobody can call you crone. Some have relied on what they knew, others on being simply true. What worked for them might work for you. No memory of having starred atones for later disregard or keeps the end from being hard. Better to go down dignified with boughten friendship at your side than none at all. Provide, provide. he would sometimes add a comment to that by saying, or else somebody else will provide for you, and how would you like that? Yeah, he had that sense of you gotta do for yourself. I don't know if that, I don't know how much theology you can get out of that poem, but certainly entertaining. Although he does say curiously, you know, some have relied on what they knew, in other words, used their connections. Others on being simply true, in other words, just being kind and honest and so forth. But then it's kind of cynical. You know, who cares? What worked for them might work for you. Just do whatever it takes. You know, feather your own nest. I always think of that poem in conjunction with Jesus' parable of the dishonest steward, Luke 16, who, you know, you may remember is fired by his master and then immediately says, I got to cover my case here. I'll call in the creditors and cut a deal and let them pay less so that when my time comes, they'll cut me a break and receive me into their household. Rings something like that. Well, got time for one more. Any?
Mending Wall.
Ah, okay. Good poem and not a bad one to end with. Mending Wall. Yeah, and you said the title correctly with the right emphasis. It's not Mending Wall, but Mending Wall. I mean, it's there isn't some entity called a mending wall, but it's Mending Wall. This is an activity he's talking about. Real-to-life experience. On his farm in New Hampshire, he had a neighbor who did live over the hill from him, and they had a stone wall. You've seen them, I'm sure, the kind of walls that are just piled stones, not like right across the way here where they're cemented into place, but just piled. And he's musing, almost like he did in Birches, about how nature works on things, how the walls don't seem to want to stay up. You know, something wants to bring them down. And what is that? What forces of nature, you know, whatever? And why do human beings feel compelled to stack them up again? I mean, that's kind of the gist of the question. Here's the poem, Mending Wall. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen groundswell under it and spills the upper boulders in the sun and makes gaps that even two could pass abreast. Now, the work of hunters is another thing. I've come after them and made repair where they've left not one stone on a stone, but they would have the rabbit out of hiding to please the yelping dogs. The gaps, I mean, no one has seen them made or heard them made, but at spring mending time, we find them there. I let my neighbor know beyond the hill, and on a day we meet to walk the line and set the wall between us once again. To each the boulders that have fallen to each. Some are loaves and some so nearly balls, we have to use a spell to make them balance. Stay where you are till our backs are turned. Just another kind of outdoor game, one on a side, it comes to little more. There where it is, we do not need a wall. He is all pine tree and I am apple orchard. My apple trees will never get across and eat the cones under his pines, I tell him. He only says, good fences make good neighbors. Spring is the mischief in me, and I wonder if I could put a notion in his head. Why do they make good neighbors? Isn't it where there are cows? But here we have no cows. Before I built a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out, and to whom I was like to give offense. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down. I could say elves to him, but it isn't elves exactly, and I'd rather he said it for himself. I see him there bringing a stone grasped firmly by the top in each hand like an old stone savage armed. It moves in darkness, as it seems to me. Not of woods only and shade of trees. He will not go behind his father's saying. And he likes having thought of it so well, he says again, good fences make good neighbors.